This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Wayward by Blake Crouch, performed by Paul Michael Garcia.
For Chad Hodge. About Wayward. An electrified fence topped with razor wire encircles the town of Wayward Pines, which also lies under 24/7 sniper surveillance. Each of the 461 residents woke up here following a catastrophic accident. There are hidden cameras in every home and business. The residents are told where to work, where to live, who to marry. Some believe they are dead and that this is an afterlife. Some think they're trapped in an experimental prison. Everyone secretly dreams of leaving, but the few who dare to try are in for a terrifying surprise. Ethan Burke has seen the world beyond. He's sheriff and one of the few who knows the truth. Wayward Pines isn't just a town. And what lies on the other side of the fence is a nightmare world beyond anyone's imagining. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. John Milton, Paradise Lost. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out. Robert Frost, Mending Wall. If you look out at nature, you find that as you tend to see suspended animation, you tend to see immorality. Mark Roth, Ph.D., cell biologist. Yesterday is history. Tomorrow is a mystery. Today is a gift. That's why it's called the present. Work hard, be happy, and enjoy your life in Wayward Pines. Notice to all residents of Wayward Pines, required to be posted prominently in every residence and place of business. Part 1, Chapter 1. Mustin had been watching the creature through the Schmidt-Bender telescope sight for the better part of an hour. It had come over the cirque at daybreak, pausing as the first radials of sunlight struck its translucent skin. Its progression down through the boulder field had been slow and careful, stopping occasionally to sniff the remains of others like it, others Mustin had killed. The sniper reached up to the scope, adjusted the parallax, and settled back in behind the focus. Conditions were ideal. Clear visibility, mild temperature, no wind. With the reticle set at 25 times zoom, the creature's ghostly silhouette popped against the gray of the shattered rock. At a distance of 1.5 miles, its head was no larger than a grain of sand. If he didn't take the shot now, he'd have to range the target again. And there was a possibility that by the time he was ready to shoot, the creature would have passed out of his sightline. It wouldn't be the end of the world. There was still a high-voltage security fence 0.5 mile down the canyon. But if it managed to scale the cliffs over the top of the razor wire, there'd be trouble. He'd have to radio in, call for a team, extra work, extra time. Every effort would be made to stop the creature from reaching town. He'd almost certainly catch an ass-chewing from Pilcher. Mustin drew in a long, deep breath, lungs expanding. He let it out, lungs deflating, then empty. His diaphragm relaxed. He counted to 3 and squeezed the trigger. The British-made AWM bucked hard against his shoulder, the report dampened by the suppressor. Recovering from the recoil, he found his target in the sphere of magnification, still crouched on a flat-topped boulder on the floor of the canyon. Damn, he'd missed. It was a longer shot than he normally took, and so many variables in play, even under perfect conditions. Barometric pressure, humidity, air density, barrel temperature, even Coriolis effect, the rotation of the earth. He thought he'd accounted for everything in calculating his aiming solution, but the creature's head disappeared in a pink mist. He smiled. It had taken a little over 4 seconds for the .338 Lapua Magnum round to reach the target. Hell of a shot. Mustin sat up, struggled to his feet, stretched his arms over his head. It was mid-morning, the sky steel blue and not a cloud in sight. His perch was atop a 30-foot guard tower that had been built on the rocky pinnacle of a mountain, far above the timberline. From the open platform, he had a panoramic view of the surrounding peaks, the canyon, the forest, and the town of Wayward Pines, which from 4,000 feet above was little more than a grid of intersecting streets, couched in a protected valley. His radio squeaked. He answered, "Muston, over." "Just had a fence strike in Zone 4, over." "Stand by." Zone 4 encompassed the expanse of pine forest that bordered the southern edge of town. He took up his rifle and glassed the fence under the canopy of trees, tracked it for a quarter mile. He saw the smoke first, coils of it lifting off the animal's scorched hide. "I have a visual," he said. "It's just a deer, over." "Copy that." Muston swung the rifle north into town. Houses appeared, colorful Victorians fronted with perfect squares of bright glass, white picket fences. He aimed down into the park where a woman pushed two children in swings. A little girl shot down the blinding glimmer of a slide. He glassed the schoolyard, the hospital, the community gardens, Main Street, fighting down that familiar swell of envy. Townies. They were oblivious, all of them, so beautifully oblivious. He didn't hate them, didn't want their life. He had long ago accepted his role as protector, guardian. Home was a sterile, windowless room inside a mountain, and he had made as much peace with that fact as a man could hope to make. But that didn't mean that, on a lonely morning, as he gazed down into what was literally the last vestige of paradise on the face of the earth, there wasn't a pang of nostalgia, of homesickness for what had once been, for what would never be again. Moving down the street, Muston fixed his sight on a man walking quickly up the sidewalk. He wore a hunter green shirt, brown pants, black Stetson cowboy hat. The brass star pinned to his lapel refracted a glint of sunlight. The man turned a corner, the crosshairs of the reticle zeroing in on his back. "Morning, Sheriff Burke," Muston said. "Feel an itch between your shoulder blades?" Chapter 2 There were still moments like this one when Wayward Pines felt like a real place. Sunlight pouring down into the valley. The morning still pleasantly cool. Pansies gemmed a planter under an open window that let the smell of a cooking breakfast waft outside. People out for morning walks. Watering lawns, collecting the local paper, beads of dew steaming off the top of a black mailbox. Ethan Burke found it tempting to linger in the moment, to pretend that everything was just as it appeared, that he lived with his wife and son in a perfect little town where he was a well-liked sheriff, where they had friends, a comfortable home, all needs provided for, and it was in the pretending that he'd come to fully understand how well the illusion worked. How people could let themselves succumb, let themselves disappear into the pretty lie that surrounded them. Bells jingled over the door as Ethan entered the steaming bean. He stepped up to the counter and smiled at the barista, a hippie chick with blonde dreads and soulful eyes. "Morning, Miranda."
"Hi, Ethan. Usual?"
"Please." While she started the espresso shots for his cappuccino, Ethan surveyed the shop. The regulars were all here, including two old-timers, Philip and Clay, hunched over a chessboard. Ethan walked over, studied the game. By the looks of it, they'd been at it for a while now, each man down to a king, queen, and several pawns. "Looks like you're headed toward a stalemate," Ethan said.
"Not so fast," Philip said. "I still got something up my sleeve."
His opponent, a gray grizzly of a man, grinned through his wild beard across the chessboard, said,
"By something, Phil means he's going to take so damn long to move that I'd die and he wins by forfeit.
Oh, shut up, Clay!"
Ethan moved on past a ratty sofa to a bookshelf. He ran his fingers across the spines. Classics. Faulkner, Dickens, Tolkien, Hugo, Joyce, Bradbury, Melville, Hawthorne, Poe, Austin, Fitzgerald, Shakespeare. At a glance, it was just a ragtag assembly of cheap paperbacks. He pulled a slim volume off the shelf, The Sun Also Rises. The cover was an impressionistic bullfighting scene. Ethan swallowed against the lump that formed in his throat. The brittle-paged, mass-market edition of Hemingway's first novel was probably the sole remaining copy in existence. It gave him goosebumps, awesome and tragic, to hold it in his hands.
"Ethan, you're all set."
He grabbed one more book for his son and went to the counter to collect his cappuccino. "Thanks, Miranda. I'm going to borrow these books, if that's okay."
"Of course,"
she smiled.
"Keep 'em straight out there, Sheriff."
"Do my best." Ethan tipped the brim of his hat and headed for the door. 10 minutes later, he pushed through the glass double doors under a sign that read, "Office of the Sheriff of Wayward Pines." Reception stood empty. Nothing new there. His secretary sat at her desk looking as bored as ever. She was playing solitaire, laying cards down at a steady, mechanical pace.
"Morning, Belinda."
"Morning, Sheriff."
She didn't look up. "Any calls?"
"No, sir."
"Anyone been by?"
"No, sir."
"How was your evening?" She glanced up, caught off guard, an ace of spades clutched in her right hand.
"What?"
It was the first time since becoming sheriff that Ethan had pushed his interaction with Belinda beyond perfunctory greetings, goodbyes, and administrative chit-chat. She'd been a pediatric nurse in her past life. He wondered if she knew that he knew that. "I was just asking how your evening was, last night."
"Oh,"
she pulled her fingers through a long silver ponytail.
"Fine."
"Do anything fun?"
"No, not really."
He thought she might return the question, inquire after his evening. But 5 seconds of uncomfortable silence and eye contact elapsed, and still she did not speak. Ethan finally rapped his knuckles on her desk. "I'll be in my office." He propped his boots up on the massive desk and kicked back in the leather chair with his steaming coffee. The head of a giant elk stared down at him from its mount across the room. Between it and 3 antique gun cases behind the desk, Ethan felt he had the trappings of a country sheriff down cold. His wife would be arriving at work about now. In her past life, Teresa had been a paralegal. In Wayward Pines, she was the town's sole realtor, which meant she spent her days sitting behind a desk in an office on Main Street that people rarely entered. Her job, like the vast majority of those assigned to the residence, was mainly cosmetic. Window dressing for a pretend town. Only 4 or 5 times a year would she actually assist someone with a new home purchase. Model residents were rewarded with the option to upgrade their home every few years. Those residents who had been here the longest and never violated the rules lived in the biggest, nicest Victorians. And those couples that became pregnant were all but guaranteed a new, more spacious home. Ethan had nothing to do and nowhere to be for the next 4 hours. He opened the book from the coffee house. The prose was terse and brilliant. He choked up at the descriptions of Paris at night. The restaurants, the bars, the music, the smoke. The lights of a real living city. The sense of a wide world brimming with diverse and fascinating people. The freedom to explore it. 40 pages in, he closed the book. He couldn't take it. Hemingway wasn't distracting him, wasn't sweeping him away from the reality of Wayward Pines. Hemingway was rubbing his face in it, pouring salt into a wound that would never heal. At 1:45, Ethan left the office on foot. He strolled through quiet neighborhoods. Everyone he passed smiled and waved, greeting him with what felt like genuine enthusiasm, as if he'd lived here for years. If they secretly feared and hated him, they hid it well. And why shouldn't they? As far as he knew, he was the sole resident of Wayward Pines who knew the truth, and it was his job to make certain it stayed that way. To keep the peace. To lie. Even from his wife and son. In his first 2 weeks as sheriff, he'd spent most of his time studying dossiers on each resident, learning the particulars of their lives before, the details of their integrations, surveillance-based reports of their lives after. He knew the personal histories of half of the town now, their secrets and fears, those who could be trusted to maintain this fragile illusion, those with hairline cracks in their veneer. He was becoming a one-man Gestapo. Necessary, he got that. But he still despised it. Ethan hit Main Street and headed down until the sidewalk and the buildings ended. The road went on, and he walked its shoulder into a forest of towering pines. The murmur of town life dropped away. 50 feet past the road sign that warned of a sharp curve ahead, Ethan stopped. He glanced back toward Wayward Pines. No cars coming. Everything still. No sound but a single bird cheeping in a tree high overhead. He stepped down from the shoulder and set off into the woods. The air smelled of pine needles warming in the sun. Ethan moved across the cushiony floor of the forest through spaces of light and shadow. He walked quickly enough to sweat through the back of his shirt, his skin cool where the fabric clung. It was a nice hike. No surveillance, no people. Just a man on a walk by himself in the woods, briefly alone with his thoughts. 200 yards from the road he reached the boulders, a collection of granite blocks scattered between the pines. At the point where the forest swept up the mountainside, a rock outcropping loomed, half buried in the earth. Ethan approached. From 10 feet away, the smooth, vertical rock face looked real, right down to the quartz vein and the bright smatterings of moss and lichen. At close range, the illusion was less convincing, the dimensions of the face just a touch too square. Ethan stood several feet back and waited. Soon he heard the muffled mechanical hum of the gears beginning to turn. The entire rock face lifted like a giant garage door, wide and tall enough to accommodate a tractor trailer. Ethan ducked under the rising door into the dank subterranean chill.
"Hello, Ethan."
"Marcus." Same escort as before, a 20-something kid with the buzzed hair and sharp jawline of a grunt or a cop. He wore a yellow windbreaker, and it dawned on Ethan that he'd forgotten to bring his jacket again. He was in for another freezing ride. Marcus had left the doorless, topless Wrangler idling and facing back up the way it had come. Ethan climbed into the front passenger seat. The entrance door thudded closed behind him. Marcus pulled the emergency brake and shifted into gear as he spoke into a headset.
"I've got Mr. Burke. We're en route."
The jeep lurched forward, accelerating on a single, unmarked lane of pristine pavement. They sped up a 15% grade. The walls of the tunnel were exposed bedrock. In places, rivulets of water came down the rock and spiderwebbed across the road. An occasional droplet starred the windshield. The fluorescent luminaries blurred past overhead in a river of morbid orange. It smelled like stone, water, and exhaust. Between the engine growl and the wind, it was too noisy for conversation. This was fine by Ethan. He leaned back into the gray vinyl seat and fought the urge to rub his arms against the constant blast of cold, wet air. Pressure built inside his ears, the roar of the engine fading. He swallowed. The noise returned. They kept climbing. At 35 miles per hour, it was only a 4-minute trip, but it seemed to take longer. Something disorienting and time-skewing in the face of all the cold and the noise and the wind. The sense of literally boring up inside a mountain. The unnerving anticipation of going to see him. The tunnel emptied into an immense cavern that contained the floor space of 10 warehouses, 1 million square feet or more. A room expansive enough for the assembly of jets or spacecraft, but instead it held provisions. Huge cylindrical reservoirs filled with food staples, long rows of shelving 40 feet high stocked with lumber and supplies, everything needed to keep the last town on Earth running for years to come. Marcus drove past a door with the word suspension stenciled across the glass. Misty blue light clouded behind the entrance, and it ran an icy finger down Ethan's spine to know what stood inside. Pilcher's suspension units. Hundreds of them. Every resident of Wayward Pines, himself included, had been chemically suspended in that room for 1,800 years. The jeep jerked to a stop beside a pair of glass doors. Marcus turned off the car as Ethan climbed out. The escort typed in a code on the keypad, and the doors whisked apart. They moved past a placard that read Level 1 into a long, empty corridor. No windows. Fluorescent lights humming. The floor was a streak of black and white checked tile. Every 10 feet stood a door inset with a small circular window. No handle, no doorknob. They opened only with a keycard. Most of the windows were dark. Through one, however, an aberration watched Ethan pass, the pupils of its large, milky eyes dilating, razor cuspids bared, a single black talon clicking on the glass. They visited him in nightmares. He'd wake dripping with sweat, reliving the attack, Teresa patting his back and whispering that he was safe at home in bed, that everything would be okay. Halfway down the corridor, they stopped at a pair of unmarked doors. Marcus swiped his key card, and they opened. Ethan stepped inside the small car. His escort inserted a key into a chrome panel, and when the sole button began to blink, pushed it. The movement was smooth. Ethan's ears always popped once during the ride, but he could never tell if they were rising or descending. It stuck in his craw that even after 2 weeks on the job, he was still escorted around this place like a child or a threat. 2 weeks. Jesus. It felt like just yesterday he'd been sitting across the desk from Adam Hassler, special agent in charge of the Seattle field office, receiving the assignment to come to this town and find Ethan's missing ex-partner, Kate Hewson. But he wasn't a Secret Service agent anymore. He still hadn't fully come to terms with that fact. The only way to know that they had stopped was that the doors opened. The first thing he saw stepping off was a Picasso, which Ethan suspected was original. They walked through a posh foyer. No fluorescent lights and checkered linoleum here. It was all marble tile and high-end wall sconces, crown molding. Even the air tasted better, none of that canned, stale-edged component found in the rest of the complex. They passed a sunken living room, a cathedral kitchen, a library walled with leather-bound volumes that smelled absolutely antique. Turning a corner, they finally headed down toward the double oak doors at the end of the hall. Marcus knocked hard twice, and a voice on the other side responded, "Come in!"
"Go ahead, Mr. Burke."
Ethan opened the doors and stepped through into a spectacular office. The floor was a dark, exotic hardwood with a high-gloss sheen. The centerpiece was a large table that displayed under glass an architectural miniature of Wayward Pines, accurate even to the color of Ethan's house. The left-hand wall was adorned with the works of Vincent van Gogh. The opposite wall consisted of a floor-to-ceiling bank of flat-screened monitors, 9 high, 24 across. Leather sofas faced the screens that showed 216 simultaneous images of Wayward Pines, streets, bedrooms, bathrooms, kitchens, backyards. Every time Ethan saw those screens, he had to stifle an irresistible impulse to tear someone's head off. He understood the purpose fully, but still. "That fury," said the man behind the intricately carved mahogany desk. "You flash it every time you come to see me." Ethan shrugged. "You're eavesdropping on private lives. Just a natural reaction." "You believe privacy should exist in our town?" "Of course not." Ethan moved toward the giant desk as the doors behind him swung shut. He shelved his Stetson under his right arm and eased down into one of the chairs. Stared at David Pilcher. He was the billionaire inventor when money meant something, behind Wayward Pines, behind this complex inside the mountain. In 1971, Pilcher had discovered that the human genome was degrading, and he'd privately predicted that humanity would cease to exist within 30 to 40 generations. So he built this suspension superstructure to preserve a number of pure humans before the genome corruption reached critical mass. In addition to his inner circle of 160 true believers, Pilcher was responsible for the abduction of 650 people, all of whom, himself included, he'd put into suspended animation. And Pilcher's prediction came true. At this very moment, beyond the electrified fence that surrounded Wayward Pines, lived hundreds of millions of what humanity had devolved into. Aberrations. And yet, Pilcher didn't own the face he'd ostensibly earned. He was a physically unthreatening man, 5'5" in boots, hairless, save for the faintest silver stubble, more chrome than winter clouds. He watched Ethan through diminutive eyes that were as black as they were unreadable. Pilcher pushed a manila folder across the leather-topped desk. "What's this?" Ethan asked. A surveillance-based report. Ethan opened the folder. It contained a black-and-white screenshot of a man he recognized. Peter McCall. The man was editor-in-chief of the town paper, The Wayward Light. In the photograph, McCall is lying on his side in bed, staring empty-eyed into nothing. "What'd he do?" Ethan asked. "Well, nothing. And that's the problem. Peter hasn't shown up for work the last 2 days." "Maybe he's been sick." "He hasn't reported feeling ill, and Ted, my head surveillance tech, got a weird vibe."
"Like he might consider running?"
"Perhaps. Or doing something reckless."
"I remember his file," Ethan said. "I don't recall any major integration issues. No subsequent insubordinate behavior. Has he said anything disturbing?"
"McCall hasn't spoken a word in 48 hours, not even to his children."
"What do you want me to do exactly?"
"Keep an eye on him. Drop by and say hello. Don't underestimate the effect your presence can have."
"You aren't considering a fate, are you?"
"No. Fates are reserved for those who exhibit true acts of treason and try to bring others along with them. You aren't wearing your sidearm."
"I think it sends the wrong message."
Pilcher smiled a mouthful of tiny white teeth. "I appreciate your taking an interest in the message I want my sole figure of authority in town to espouse. I mean that. What would your message be, Ethan?"
"That I'm here to help, to support, to protect."
"But you are not actually there to do any of those things." "I've been unclear. This is my fault. Your presence is a reminder of my presence."
"Got it.
So the next time I spot you walking down the street on one of my screens, can I expect to see your biggest, baddest gun bulging off your hip?"
"For sure."
"Excellent."
Ethan could feel his heart punching against his ribs with a furious intensity.
"Please don't take this minor rebuke to be my overall impression of your work, Ethan. I think you're integrating nicely into your new position. Would you agree?"
Ethan glanced over Pilcher's shoulder. The wall behind the desk was solid rock. In the center, a large window had been cut into the stone. The view was of the mountains, the canyon, and Wayward Pines, 2,000 feet below.
"I think I'm getting more comfortable with my job," Ethan said.
"You've been rigorously studying the resident files?"
"I've gotten through all of them once."
"Your predecessor, Mr. Pope, had them memorized."
"I'll get there."
"Glad to hear it. But you weren't studying them this morning, correct?"
"You were watching me."
"Not watching you, but your office popped up a few times on the monitors. What was that you were reading? I couldn't make it out."
"The sun also rises."
"Ah, Hemingway, one of my favorites. You know, I still believe that great art will be created here. I brought along our pianist, Hector Gaither, for that explicit reason. I have other renowned novelists and painters in suspension, poets, and we're always looking for talent to nurture in the school. Ben is thriving in his art class."
Ethan bristled internally at Pilcher's mention of his son, but he only said, "The residents of Pines are in no state of mind to make art."
"What do you mean by that, Ethan?"
Pilcher asked it like a therapist might, the question charged with intellectual curiosity, not aggression. "They live under constant surveillance. They know they can never leave. What kind of art would a repressed society possibly be motivated to create?"
Pilcher smiled. "Ethan, to hear you talk, I wonder if you're fully on board with me. If you actually believe in what we're doing."
"Of course I believe."
"Of course you do.
A report came across my desk today from one of my nomads just returned from a 2-week mission. He saw a swarm of abbeys 2,000 strong only 20 miles from the center of Wayward Pines. They were moving across the plains east of the mountains, chasing a herd of buffalo. Every day I'm reminded how vulnerable we are in this valley. How tenuous, how fragile our existence. And you sit there and look at me like I'm running the GDR or the Khmer Rouge. You don't like it. I can respect that.
Hell, I wish it could be different, but there are reasons for the things I do, and these reasons are based upon the preservation of life, of our species.
Aren't there always reasons?
You're a man of conscience, and I appreciate that, Pilcher said. I wouldn't have someone in your position of power who wasn't. Every resource I have, every person under my employ, is devoted to one thing. Keeping the 461 people in that valley, your wife and son included, safe.
What about the truth? Ethan asked.
In some environments, safety and truth are natural-born enemies. I would think a former employee of the federal government could grasp that concept.
Ethan glanced over at the wall of screens. On one in the lower left-hand corner, his wife appeared, sitting alone in her office on Main Street. Motionless, bored. The screen adjacent to hers showed a camera feed unlike anything Ethan had seen, a bird's-eye view of something flying 100 feet above a dense forest at a considerable rate of speed.
"What's that camera feed?" Ethan asked, pointing at the wall.
"Which one?"
The image was replaced by a camera shot from inside the opera house.
It's gone now, but it looked like something flying at a treetop level.
Oh, that's just one of my UAVs.
UAV?
Unmanned aerial vehicle. It's an MQ-9 Reaper drone. We send them out every so often on reconnaissance missions. Has a range of about 1,000 miles. Today I believe it's flying south to do a loop around the Great Salt Lake.
Ever find anything?
Not yet. Look, Ethan, I'm not asking you to like all of this. I don't like it.
"Where are we going?" Ethan asked, as the image of his wife was replaced with the image of two boys building sandcastles in a sandbox.
"As a species, I mean."
He fixed his gaze back on Pilcher. "I get what you've done here, that you've preserved our existence far beyond what evolution had in mind. But was it just for this, so a small contingent of humanity could live in a valley under 24/7 surveillance, shielded from the truth, occasionally forced to kill one of their own? It's not a life, David. It's a prison sentence. And you've made me the warden. I want the best for these people, for my family."
Pilcher rolled back in his chair away from the desk, spun it around, and stared through the glass at the town he had made.
"We've been here 14 years, Ethan. There are less than 1,000 of us, and hundreds of millions of them. Sometimes the best you can do is simply survive."
The camouflaged tunnel door closed shut behind him. Ethan stood alone in the woods. He moved away from the rock outcropping back toward the road. The sun had already dropped behind the western wall of cliffs, a crisp golden quality to the sky, a night is coming chill to the air. The road into Pines was empty, and Ethan walked down the middle of the double yellow. Home was 1040 6th Street, a Victorian just a few blocks from Main, yellow with white trim, pleasant and creaky. Ethan moved across the flagstones and up onto the porch. He opened the screen door, the solid wood door, stepped inside, said, "Honey, I'm home." There was no answer. Only the silent, clenched energy of an empty house. He topped the coat rack with his cowboy hat and sat down on a ladder-back chair to wrestle off his boots. In sock feet, he crossed to the kitchen. The milk had come. 4 glass bottles rattled against one another when he pulled open the door to the fridge. He grabbed one and carried it down the hallway into the study. This was Ethan's favorite room in the house. If he sat in the oversized upholstered chair by the window, he could bask in the knowledge that he wasn't being watched. Most buildings in Pines had 1 or 2 blind spots. On his 3rd trip to the superstructure, he'd gotten his hands on the surveillance schematics for his house, memorized the location of every camera. He'd asked Pilcher if he could have them removed and been denied. Pilcher wanted Ethan to have the full experience of living under surveillance so he could relate to the people under his authority. There was comfort in knowing that in this moment no one could see him. Of course, they knew his precise location at all times thanks to the microchip embedded under his hamstring. Ethan had known better than to ask if he could be exempt from that security measure. Ethan popped the top off the glass bottle and took a swig. It wasn't the kind of thing he could say to Teresa with people listening, but he'd often thought that out of all the terrible hardships attendant to their life in Pines, no privacy, no freedom, the ever-present threat of death, this daily milk from the dairy in the southeast corner of the valley had to be the one bright spot. It was cold and creamy and fresh, with a grassy sweetness. Out the window, he could see into the next-door neighbor's backyard. Jennifer Rochester knelt over a raised flowerbed, scooping in handfuls of soil from a red wheelbarrow. He recalled her file before he could stop the thought. In her past life, she'd been a professor of education at Washington State University. Here in Pines, she waited tables four nights a week at the Beer Garden. With the exception of a brutal interrogation that almost didn't take, she had been a model resident. Stop. He didn't want to think about work, about the private details of his neighbors' lives. What must they think of him under the surface? He shuddered at his life. They hit him occasionally, those moments of despair. There was no way out, no other man he could be, not if he wanted to keep his family safe. That had been made abundantly clear. Ethan knew he should probably read the report on McCall, but instead he opened a drawer in the accent table beside him and took out the book of poetry. Robert Frost. A short collection of his nature poems. Whereas Hemingway had crushed him this morning, in Frost, Ethan always found solace. He read for an hour. Of mending walls and snowy woods and roads not taken. The sky darkened. He heard his wife's footsteps on the porch. Ethan met her at the door. "How was your day?" he asked. Teresa's eyes seemed to whisper, "I sat behind a desk for 8 hours at a meaningless job and didn't speak to another soul." But she forced a smile and said, "It was great. And yours?" "I met with the man responsible for this prison we call home and picked up a secret file on one of our neighbors." "Mine was great, too." She ran her hand down his chest. "I'm glad you didn't change yet. I love you in uniform." Ethan embraced his wife, breathed in her smell, fingers gliding through her long blonde hair. "I was thinking," she said. "Yeah?" "Ben won't be home from Matthew's for another hour."
"Is that right?"
She took Ethan by the hand and pulled him toward the staircase.
"You sure?" he asked. They'd only been together twice in the 2 weeks since their reunion, both times in Ethan's favorite chair in the study, Teresa sitting in his lap, his hands on her hips, an awkward entanglement.
"I want you," she said.
"Let's go in the study."
"No," she said. "Our bed." He followed her up the steps and down the second-floor hallway, the hard wood groaning under their footfalls. They stumbled, kissing into the bed, their hands all over each other, Ethan trying to ground himself in the moment, but he couldn't push the cameras out of his mind. One behind the thermostat on the wall beside the bathroom door. One in the light fixture in the ceiling, looking straight down on their bed. He was hesitating, conflicted, and Teresa sensed it.
"What's wrong, baby?" she said.
"Nothing." They were standing beside the bed. Out the window, the lights of Pines were coming on, street lamps, porch lights, house lights. A cricket started up, its chirping sliding through the open window. Quintessential sound of a peaceful night. Only it wasn't real. There were no crickets anymore. The sound came from a tiny speaker hidden in a bush. He wondered if his wife knew that. Wondered how much of the truth she suspected.
"Do you want me?"
Teresa asked in that no-bullshit tone he'd fallen for the first time they'd met.
"Of course I do." "So do something about it."
He took his time unbuttoning the back of her white summer dress, badly out of practice, but there was something wonderfully terrifying because of the rust. Not like high school, but close. A lack of control that had him hard before they'd even made it into the room. He tried to pull the covers over them, but she wouldn't have it. Told him she wanted to feel the cool breeze coming through the window across the surface of her skin. It was a good old-fashioned bed and, like the rest of the house, creaky as hell. The bedsprings squeaked, and as Teresa moaned, Ethan tried to put the knowledge of the camera above them out of his mind. Pilcher had assured him that watching couples in their private moments was strictly forbidden, that camera feeds were always killed when the clothes came off. But Ethan wondered if that was true, or if some surveillance tech was watching as he fucked his wife, studying Ethan's bare ass, the bend of Teresa's leg as they wrapped around his body. Their first two times together, Ethan had come before Teresa. Now the thought of the camera above him cut into the pleasure. He used the anger to make himself last. Teresa came with a vengeance that reminded Ethan of how good they could be together. He let himself finish, and then they were still, breathless, and he could feel her heart jackhammering against his ribs. The evening air almost cold where it grazed his sweaty skin. It might have been a perfect moment, but the knowledge of everything elbowed in. Would he reach the point one day when he could shut that off? Just take these unexpected respites of peace for their surface beauty and forget the underlying horror? Was that how people managed to live here for years without losing their minds? "So we can still do that," he said, and they laughed. "Next time we'll take off the training wheels," she said. "I like the sound of that." He rolled over and Teresa curled into him. Ethan made sure her eyes were closed. Then he smiled straight up at the ceiling and raised his middle finger. Ethan and Teresa worked on dinner together, chopping side by side on the butcher block counter. It was harvest time in the community gardens, the end of the season, and the Burke's fridge was loaded down with their share of fresh veggies and fruit. These were, without a doubt, the prime eating months of the year in Wayward Pines. Once the leaves had been burnt with frost and the snow line had begun its rapid descent to the valley floor, the food took a disastrous turn for the freeze-dried. October through March, they could look forward to 6 months of prepackaged, dehydrated shit. Teresa had already warned Ethan that walking through the town grocery in December was like shopping for a space mission. Nothing but shelf after shelf of chrome-colored packaging, labeled with the most outrageous dares. Creme brulee, grilled cheese sandwich, filet mignon, lobster tail. She had already threatened to serve him freeze-dried steak and lobster for their Christmas dinner. They had just finished preparing the hearty salad, onions, radishes, and raspberries over a bed of spinach and red lettuce, when Ben crashed through the front door, rouge-cheeked, smelling of boy sweat and the outdoors. Still caught in that delicate blink of time between boy and man. Teresa went to her son and kissed him and asked about his day. Ethan turned on the vintage Philips, a tube radio from the 1950s in immaculate condition. Pilcher had inexplicably put one in every inhabited house. Surfing was easy with one station to choose from. Most of the time, it just blared static, but there were one or two talk shows, and always, between 7 and 8 o'clock, Dinner with Hector. Hector Gaither had been a moderately famous concert pianist in his past life. In Pines, he taught lessons to anyone who wanted to learn, and every night of the week played music for the town. Ethan turned up the volume, heard Hector's voice as he joined his family. "Good evening, Wayward Pines. Hector Gaither here." At the head of the table, Ethan dished out servings of their salad. "I'm sitting at my Steinway, a gorgeous Boston baby grand." First to his wife. "Tonight I'll be playing the Goldberg Variations, a work originally composed for harpsichord by Johann Sebastian Bach." Then to his son. "The construction of this piece is an aria followed by 30 variations. Please enjoy." As Ethan served himself and took a seat, he heard the creak of the piano bench come crackling through the speaker. After dinner, the Burks took bowls of homemade ice cream out onto the porch, sat in rocking chairs, eating and listening. Through the open windows of the neighboring houses, Ethan could hear Hector's music. It filled the valley, precise and radiant notes bubbling up between the mountain walls that had become ruddy with alpenglow. They stayed out late. A millennium without air or light pollution made for pitch-black skies. The stars didn't just appear anymore. They exploded. Diamonds on black velvet. You couldn't tear your eyes away. Ethan reached over and held Teresa's hand. Bach and galaxies. The night grew cool, When Hector finished, people clapped inside their homes. Across the street, a man shouted, "Bravo! Bravo!" Ethan looked over at Teresa. Her eyes were wet. He said, "You okay?" She nodded, wiping her face. "I'm just so glad to have you home." Ethan finished the dishes, headed upstairs. Ben's room was at the far end of the hall, and the door was closed, just a razor line of light visible underneath. Ethan knocked. "Come in." Ben was sitting up in bed sketching, charcoal on butcher paper. Ethan eased down on the comforter, asked, "Can I take a look?" Ben lifted his arms. The sketch was the boy's current vantage point from the bed, the wall, the desk, the window frame, the points of light outside which were visible through the glass. "That's amazing," Ethan said. "It's not exactly what I want. The night through the window doesn't really look like night." "I'm sure it'll get there." "Hey, I picked up a book from the coffee shop today." Ben perked up. "What is it?" "It's called The Hobbit." "I never heard of it." "It was one of my favorite books when I was your age. I thought maybe I could read it to you." "I know how to read, Dad." "I know, but I haven't read this in years. Might be fun to read it together." "Is it scary?" "It has some scary parts. Go brush your teeth and hurry back." Ethan sat against the headboard, reading by the light of a bedside table lamp. Ben was asleep before the end of the first chapter, dreaming, Ethan hoped, of dungeons deep and caverns old, of something other than wayward pines. Ethan set the paperback aside and cut the lamp, pulled the blanket up to his son's shoulders. He laid his hand down against Ben's back. Nothing better in the world than feeling the rise and fall of his child's sleeping respirations. Ethan had still not recovered from his son growing up in wayward pines, doubted it was something he would ever accept. There were small things which he tried to tell himself were better. Tonight, for instance. Had Ben grown up in the old world, Ethan would probably have entered his son's bedroom to find him glued to an iPhone, texting friends, watching television, playing video games, Twitter and Facebook. Ethan didn't miss those things, didn't wish that his son was growing up in a world where people stared at screens all day, where communication had devolved into the tapping of tiny letters, and humanity lived by and large for the endorphin kick from the ping of a received text or a new email. Instead, he'd found his almost teenage son passing his time before bed by sketching. Hard to feel bad about that. But it was the years to come that weighed down on Ethan's heart with the black pressure of depression. What did Ben have to look forward to? There would be no higher learning, no real career. Gone were the days of, you can be whatever you want to be, whatever you set your mind to, just follow your heart and your dreams. Golden age platitudes of an extinct species. When people failed to pair up on their own, marriages in pines were often suggested. And even when they weren't, the pool of potential mates wasn't exactly deep. Ben would never see Paris. Or Yellowstone. Might never fall in love. He would never have the experience of going away to college, or on a honeymoon, or driving across the country nonstop, spur of the moment, just because he was 22 and could. Ethan hated the surveillance and the abbeys and Pines's culture of illusion. But what kept him up with his mind racing late into the night were thoughts of his son. Ben had lived in Pines for 5 years, almost as long as he'd lived in the world before. Whereas Ethan suspected that the adult residents of Pines struggled every day with the memory of their past lives, Ben was very much a product of this town, of this strange new time. Not even Ethan was privy to the things his son was being taught in school. Pilcher kept a pair of his men in plain clothes on school property at all times, and parents weren't allowed inside. 3:30 a.m. Ethan lay awake in his bed, his wife in his arms, miles from sleep. He could feel Teresa's eyelashes scraping against his chest with each blink. "What are you thinking?" The question had haunted their marriage before, but in Pines it had assumed an entirely new gravity. In the 14 days they'd been together, Teresa had never broken the surface illusion. Of course, she had welcomed Ethan back home. There'd been a tearful reunion, but
5 years as a resident of Pines had made her a stone-cold pro. There was no talk of where Ethan had been or of his tumultuous integration, no mention or discussion of the strange events surrounding his becoming sheriff, or what he might now know. Sometimes he thought he caught a glint of something in Teresa's eyes, an acknowledgement of their circumstance, a suppressed desire to communicate on a forbidden level. But like a good actor, she never broke character. More and more he was coming to realize that living in Pines was like living in an elaborate play whose curtain never closed. Everyone had their parts. Shakespeare could have been writing about Pines. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. Ethan had already played a few of his own. Downstairs, the telephone was ringing. Teresa sat up as if she'd been spring-loaded, no sign of bleariness, snapped instantly to attention, her face gone tight with fear. "Is it everyone's phone?" she asked, her voice filled with dread. Ethan climbed out of bed. "No, honey. Go back to sleep. It's just ours. It's just for me." Ethan caught it on the sixth ring, standing in his boxers in the living room, the rotary phone clutched between his shoulder and his ear. "For a moment I wondered if you were going to answer," Pilcher's voice. He'd never called Ethan at home before. "Do you know what time it is?" Ethan said. "Terribly sorry to have woken you. Did you get a chance to read the surveillance report on Peter McCall?" "Yeah," Ethan lied. "But you didn't go and talk with him like I suggested, did you?" "I was planning to go first thing tomorrow." "Don't bother. He's decided to take his leave of us tonight."
"He's outside?"
"Yeah."
"So maybe he went for a walk."
30 seconds ago, his signal reached the curve of the road at the end of town and kept right on heading south."
"What do you want me to do?"
There was a beat of silence on the other end of the line. Somehow, Ethan could feel the frustration coming through like a heat lamp. Pilcher said evenly,
"Stop him. Talk some sense into him."
"But I don't know exactly what you want me to say.
I realize this is your first runner. Don't worry about what to say. Just trust your gut. I'll be listening."
"Listening?"
A dial tone blared in Ethan's ear. He crept upstairs and dressed in the darkness. Teresa was still awake, sitting up in bed and watching as he threaded his belt through the loops.
"Everything okay, honey?" she asked.
"Fine," Ethan said. "Work stuff."
"Yeah, just have to stop one of our neighbors from trying to leave our little slice of paradise in the middle of the night. No big deal. Nothing weird here." Ethan walked over and kissed his wife on the forehead.
"I'll be back as soon as I can, hopefully before morning."
She didn't say anything, only grabbed his hand and squeezed hard enough to move the bones. Nighttime in Wayward Pines. A wonderland of stillness. The crickets turned off. So quiet, Ethan could hear the street lamps humming, the pounding of his own biologic engine. He walked down to the curb and climbed into the black Ford Bronco, with a light bar across the roof and on the doors, the exact WP emblem that was engraved on his sheriff's star. The engine gargled. Ethan shifted into gear. Tried to pull gently out into the street, but the 4.9-liter straight-six had been bored out and was loud as hell. The noise would undoubtedly wake people. Cars were rarely driven in Pines. You could cross town on foot in 15 minutes. Cars were never driven in Pines at night. Their purpose was decorative, and anyone whose slumber was disturbed by the roar of Ethan's Bronco would know that something had come off the rails. He turned onto Main and headed south. After the hospital, he hit the high beams and pushed the gas pedal into the floor, accelerating into a narrow corridor of tall pines. With the window down, the cold forest air streamed in. He drove down the middle of the road, tires straddling the double yellow, imagining there was no turn coming, that soon the road would begin to climb. Out of this valley, away from this town. He would reach down and turn on the radio, surf the airwaves until he found a station that played the oldies. It would be a 3-hour trip back to Boise. Nothing like driving on an open road at night with the windows down and good music blasting.
It was only for a split second, but he caught the feeling of living in a world full of others like him. A nightscape light-ridden with the glow of great cities, the distant roar of interstate traffic and jets thundering through the stratosphere. The sense of not being so goddamn alone. The endlings of their species, of humanity. The speedometer needle edged toward 70, the engine screaming. He'd already blown past the sharp curve ahead sign. Ethan stomped on the brake and lurched forward as the Bronco skidded to a stop in the vertex of the curve. He pulled over to the shoulder, killed the engine, climbed out. Soles of his boots scraping across the pavement. For a moment he hesitated with the door open, staring at the Winchester 97 cradled in the gun rack above the seats. He didn't want to take it for the message it might send to McCall. He didn't want to leave it because these were dark and scary woods, and the world they bordered hostile beyond reckoning. There had never been a fence breach to his knowledge, but there was a first time for everything, and being out in these trees in the middle of the night unarmed was just taunting Murphy's Law. Leaning back in, he opened the center console and jammed his pockets full with shells. Then he reached up and lifted the 12-gauge off the rack. It was a pump-action tube feed with a walnut stock and 15 inches of the barrel sawn off. Ethan fed in 5 shells, racked one into the chamber, and set the hammer to half-cocked, the closest thing to a safety on this beautiful dinosaur of a weapon. With the shotgun laid across his shoulder blades and his arms draped over the stock and barrel, Ethan stepped down off the shoulder and started into the woods. Colder here than in town. A yard-thick blanket of mist hovered over the floor of the forest. The moon had yet to clear the wall cliffs. It was dark enough under the trees for a flashlight. Ethan turned on the beam, moved deeper into the woods, trying to keep on the straightest trajectory possible so he could find his way back to the road. Ethan heard the electrified hum before he saw it, cutting through the mist like a sustained bass note. The profile of the fence disappeared in the distance, a rampart running through the forest. As he drew near, details emerged. 25-foot steel pylons paced 75 feet apart, bundles of conductors stretched between them, separated every 10 feet with spacers, the cables an inch thick, studded with spikes and enwrapped with razor wire. There was ongoing debate within Pilcher's inner circle regarding whether the fence would remain viable in a loss-of-power situation, whether or not the height and the razor wire alone could keep the Abbeys out. Ethan figured there wasn't much of anything that could stop several thousand starving Abbeys from tearing through if they wanted, with or without electricity. Ethan stopped 5 feet from the wire. He broke off 2 low-hanging limbs and marked the spot with an X. Then he headed east, walking parallel to the fence. After a quarter mile, he stopped to listen. There was the constant hum. His own breathing. The sound of something moving through the forest on the other side of the fence. Footfalls in pine needles. The occasional snap of a branch. A deer? An Abbey? Sheriff? The voice straightened Ethan's spine like an electrical current had ripped through it, and he swung the shotgun off his shoulders and leveled the barrel on Peter McCall. The man stood 10 feet away beside the trunk of a giant pine, dressed in dark clothes and a black baseball cap. He had a small backpack slung over his shoulder. To the pack, he'd lashed 2 plastic milk jugs filled with water, which sloshed as he stepped forward. He carried no weapon that Ethan could see beyond a walking stick with more curve than an old man's backbone. "Jesus, Peter! What the hell are you doing out here?" The man smiled, but Ethan saw fear in it. "If I said I was just out for a late walk, would you believe me?" Ethan lowered the shotgun. "You shouldn't be out here." "I'd heard rumors there was a fence in these woods. Always wanted to see it." "Well, there it is. You've seen it. Let's walk back to town," Peter said. "Before I built the wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out. Robert Frost wrote that." Ethan wanted to say he knew that he'd been reading Frost, that very poem, in fact, just several hours ago. "So, lawman," McCall said, pointing at the fence, "are you walling us in, or walling something out.
It's time to go home, Peter.
Is it now?
Yeah.
And by that, do you mean my house in Wayward Pines? Or my real home in Missoula?
Ethan edged forward. You've been here 8 years, Peter. You are an important member of this community. You provide an essential service.
The Wayward Light? Come on, that paper's a joke.
Your family is here.
Where is here? What does that even mean? I know there are people who have found happiness and peace in this valley. I tried to convince myself I had, but it was a lie. I should have done this years ago. I sold myself out.
I get that it's hard.
Do you? Because from my perspective, you've been in Pines all of 5 minutes. And before they made you sheriff, you couldn't get out fast enough.
So what changed?
Did you actually make it?
Ethan set his jaw.
You made it past the fence, didn't you? What did you see? What turned you into a true believer?
I hear there are demons on the other side.
But that's just a fairy tale, right?
Ethan set the butt of the Winchester on the ground, leaned the barrel against a tree.
Tell me what's out there,
McCall said. Do you love your family? Ethan asked.
I need to know. You, of all people, should...
Do you love your family? The question finally seemed to register.
I used to. When we were real people. When we could talk about the things in our hearts. You know, this is the first real conversation I've had in years.
Ethan said, Peter, this is your last chance. Are you going to come back with me?
My last chance, huh?
Yeah.
Or what? All the phones will start to ring? You'll disappear me yourself?
There's nothing for you out there, Ethan said.
At least there'd be answers.
What's it worth to you to know? Your life? Your freedom? McCall laughed bitterly.
You call that, he gestured behind him in the general direction of town, freedom?
I call it your only option, Peter. The man stared at the ground for a moment and then shook his head.
You're wrong.
How's that?
Tell my wife and daughter I love them.
How am I wrong, Peter?
There's never only one option.
His face hardened. Sudden onset of resolve. He shot past Ethan like he'd exploded out of the starting blocks, still accelerating when he struck the fence. Sparks. Arcs stabbing into McCall from the wire like blue daggers. The force of the voltage blasted Peter 10 feet back from the fence into a tree.
Peter!
Ethan knelt at the man's side, but Peter was gone. Lesioned with electrical burns, crumpled and drawn. Motionless. Sizzling. Smoking. The air reeked of charred hair and skin, his clothes polka-dotted with smoldering, fire-rimmed holes.
For the best, really,
Ethan spun. Pam stood leaning against the tree behind him, smiling in the darkness. Her clothes as black as the shadows under the pines, only her eyes and her teeth visible. And the moon of her pretty face. Pilcher's beautiful pit bull. She pushed off the tree and moved toward Ethan like the natural fighter she was, slinking, graceful, cat-like, complete body control and economy of movement. He hated to admit it, but she scared him. In his past life work with the Secret Service, he'd only encountered 3 pure psychopaths. He felt confident Pam was one. She squatted down beside him.
It's like yuck, but also makes me hungry for barbecue.
Is that weird?
Don't worry. You don't have to clean this up. They'll send a team.
I wasn't worrying about that.
Oh?
I was thinking about this poor man's family.
Well, at least they didn't have to watch him get beat to death in the street. And let's face it, that's where this was heading.
I thought I could convince him.
If he'd been a new arrival, maybe. But Peter snapped. Perfect resident for 8 years, not so much as a negative surveillance report until this week. Then suddenly, he's off in the middle of the night with provisions.